VOA News. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting. Afghan officials say at least 50 people were killed and 83 wounded in a suicide bomb blast at a gathering of religious scholars in the capital, Kabul, on Tuesday. The attacker detonated his explosives-filled vest as the 1,000 or so scholars gathered to mark the Prophet Muhammad's birthday at a local wedding hall. The Taliban condemned the suicide bombing against the religious gathering, that denial strengthening suspicions the bombing could be the work of the Islamic State's Afghan branch. Abandoning Saudi Arabia despite its responsibility for killing a U.S.-based journalist would be a terrible mistake, President Trump said on Tuesday. He was asked by reporters about a reported conclusion by the CIA that the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman likely knew about or ordered the plot to kill dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul.
The CIA has looked at it. They've studied it a lot. They have nothing definitive. And the fact is, maybe he did, maybe he didn't.
Earlier in the day, in a statement issued by the White House, Trump said he understands that some lawmakers in Congress who, for political or other reasons, want to pursue sanctions against Saudi Arabia for the killing and said they are free to do so. A U.S. federal judge has ordered the Trump administration to free about 100 Iraqi immigrants it's been holding for more than 6 months for deportation. The judge criticized the government for what he called its ignoble behavior and for making false statements in the case. He said families have been shattered and ordered officials to release the immigrants within 30 days. The judge also said he would announce sanctions against the government in a separate ruling. This is VOA News. A federal judge in Detroit says regulating female genital mutilation is up to states, and Congress had no authority to pass the 1996 law banning it. The judge dismissed mutilation and conspiracy charges on Tuesday against two doctors and others involved in the procedure on nine girls at a clinic near Detroit. A spokeswoman says the U.S. Attorney's Office is reviewing the opinion. The United States has imposed sanctions on six people and three entities for their involvement in oil shipments to Syria. American officials said Iran has been working with Russian companies to ship millions of barrels of oil to Syria. A federal judge on Tuesday temporarily barred the Trump administration from refusing to grant asylum to immigrants who crossed the southern border illegally. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
The request was made by the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights, which quickly sued after President Trump issued the ban this month in response to the caravans of migrants that have started to arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border.
A former Mexican drug trafficker has been detailing the workings of El Chapo's operations at the drug lord's trial in Brooklyn. Associated Press correspondent Warren Levinson reports.
In the better part of a week on the witness stand, Jesus Zambada described the Sinaloa drug cartel as an enterprise where bribery and murder were part of the business model. Zambada described Joaquin Guzman, the drug lord nicknamed El Chapo, as a top officer in the cartel carrying around a diamond-encrusted pistol, paying off police who got close to arresting him, ordering the killing of those who crossed or insulted him. The defense claims Guzman has been set up by other drug lords, that cooperators like Zambada are just telling the government what it wants to hear to lighten their own punishment. The charges against Guzman carry a life sentence.
Marijuana smokers in Massachusetts can now legally buy marijuana for recreational use. Associated Press correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
I was here at 420.
More than 2 years after Massachusetts voters approved the recreational use of marijuana, it's now available for purchase. Dennis DeForge was at a shop in Northampton.
And because I was one of the first 10 people, I got it for a buck.
He spoke to WHDH, as did the store's first customer, Northampton's mayor, David Narkowitz. He says people have been buying and selling marijuana for centuries, and legalizing it is a good thing.
This has a label on it. This has, you know, ingredients. It's been tested.
Massachusetts' other legal marijuana shop is in Leicester. They're the first two shops on the entire East Coast.
Haiti faced a third day of protests and violence on Tuesday as anger continues to grow over allegations of government corruption. You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world, around the clock, at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Christopher Cruz, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, November 21st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Congo's ruling coalition candidate unveils his manifesto ahead of tomorrow's official start of campaigning.
If you consider opposition, they have no common candidate, they have no common manifesto. So, considering things in the scene, we can say probably Mr. Shadari is on his way to win.
Andre Alain Atundu is the spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition. Meanwhile, opposition coalition candidate is due back in the country tomorrow, Wednesday, from Geneva, where he was chosen. Rwanda's new foreign affairs minister will discuss regional relations, and Zambia's main opposition party says it will participate in the national dialogue on electoral reforms.
This is what I've been waiting for. And now that the three church mother bodies have agreed to spearhead the dialogue process, the UPND are ready to take part in the dialogue process.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, UPND. Environmental activists are calling on Uganda's government to fund anti-climate change activities. And what caused the recent deaths of two black rhinos in Charles Zakoma National Park? Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Tomorrow, Thursday, is the official start of campaign in the Democratic Republic of Congo for the December 23rd presidential election. On Monday this week, the candidate for President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition, Emmanuel Ramazani Shadari, announced an $86 billion five-year development plan, which he said will diversify the economy and create jobs. Andre Alain Atundu, spokesman for Mr. Kabila's ruling coalition, says the party's strong platform, coupled with divisions in the opposition over a unified candidate, could mean that Mr. Shadari is on his way to winning the December poll.
There are four power points. First of all is to increase the state authority and to organize a competitive economy. And four is to try to rehabilitate the dignity of the Congolese nation.
The ruling coalition has been in power for many years now. The question that many will be asking is, did this government under President Kabila do much to diversify the economy, to create jobs for the Congolese people, and to fight poverty? Because that's what Mr. Shadari says he's going to do.
Yes. All President Kabila has done is like the way to pave the action of Mr. Shadari. If President Kabila didn't do so, it should be difficult, quite impossible for Mr. Shadari to have such ambition.
Tomorrow, Thursday, is the beginning of campaigning for the December 23rd election. What should the Congolese people look forward to for the ruling party on Thursday?
The Congolese people is waiting that all the candidates propose them a credible manifesto, which is very difficult for the party of opposition. Congolese majority coalition presents its manifesto, but what about the opposition party? They are still quarreling about who is the candidate. So I think they are not really prepared to face the election properly.
But the opposition has chosen Mr. Fayulu as their candidate.
As you know, Mr. Kamere and Mr. Tshisekedi withdraw their signatures. They don't recognize anymore Mr. Fayulu as the candidate. This is a real problem for them.
So do you think this paves the way for Mr. Shadari to win the election next month?
As you know, election is a competition. You cannot say at the beginning that you will be the winner. What we say, Mr. Shadari has an advantage. First of all, that he's the lone candidate of the coalition majority. There is no contest or quarrel about his candidates. Secondly, his manifesto is a common manifesto. If you consider opposition, they have no common candidate, they have no common manifesto. So, considering things in the scene, we can say probably Mr. Shabari is on his way to win.
Andre Alain Atundu is the spokesman for DRC President Joseph Kabila's ruling coalition. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, opposition coalition presidential candidate Martin Fayulu is due back in the country today, Wednesday, from Geneva, where he was chosen last week. And as official campaigning gets underway tomorrow, Thursday, some members of the opposition coalition are still refusing to back Mr. Fayulu. Freddy Matungulu, leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, a member of the opposition coalition, says the opposition is still concerned about the use of voting machines in the December poll.
The most important thing that happened on Wednesday the 21st is the return in Kinshasa of the single candidate who was returning from that trip in Europe. As we speak right now, the idea for us, of course, is to regroup after what happened on Monday, the 12th of November. We are ready to begin campaigning, but as you know, we still have this problem with the voting machine that is here. And our intention is, as we've indicated all along, to continue fighting to get rid of this voting machine. So, big chunk of what we're doing when we are campaigning is essentially continuing to stress the need for this voting machine to be removed from the electoral process.
The last time we spoke, as you mentioned, that there were some problems with the coalition that you tried to build. Which of the leaders did you say have left the coalition?
The leader of UDPS, Felix Tshisekedi, and the one for UNC, Vital Kamerhe. These are the two who are no longer part of the coalition. We are continuing informal discussions with the groups to try to get them to return to this coalition. But as we speak right now, they have not returned to the coalition yet.
So what does that do to the chances of your coalition in winning the December 23rd election?
Well, there's no question about the fact that we've been fighting all along to be able to have a large coalition, including those two leaders who have left. And that, as far as I'm concerned, is not, you know, an encouraging development. But at the same time, I think, you know, if you look and you listen to what people here in the country are saying, the demand remains very strong for the opposition to continue working with this group. In fact, the defection has been largely condemned by the population here in Kinshasa, as well as in much of the country, because it is seen as an act that is going to be favoring Kabila and his group. And for that reason, the electorate doesn't seem to be willing to go along with the split that has been created.
The opposition keeps talking about the voting machines, but it doesn't seem that the Elections Commission, CENE, is going to do anything about the voting machines. That means you will have to go to the election on December 23rd with the voting machines.
It is still our view that this voting machine will be removed because we'll continue putting pressure on the government. And as far as we are concerned, at any one point in time, taking into account the capacity that is here within the country and available eventually from our partners, it is always possible to, of course, on an expeditious, accelerated mode to try to get to print the paper ballot. And this is, you know, what we're working hard trying to achieve with the mounting pressure that is being put on the government.
Freddy Matungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party. He was speaking with me from the DRC capital, Kinshasa, today's Wednesday, November 21st. And you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 15 minutes past the hour. Zambia's main opposition, United Party for National Development, UPND, says it will participate in a national dialogue on electoral reforms and political tension and violence. The opposition group had earlier refused to take part after accusing the government of planning to hijack the process, an accusation that President Edgar Lungu's administration has rejected. Now, the UPND says it will be part of the meetings organized by three Zambian church groups: the Council of Churches in Zambia, the Evangelical Fellowship of Zambia, and the Zambia Conference of Catholic Bishops. The groups also organized a meeting between President Lungu and UPND leader Hakainde Hichilema. Charles Kakoma is UPND spokesman.
This is what I've been waiting for. We are pressing for the three church mother bodies, which is the Catholics, the Pentecostals, and the Evangelicals, to lead the dialogue process. This was after the ruling party, led by President Edgar Lungu, refused to have the dialogue under the Commonwealth auspices. And now that the three church mother bodies have agreed to spearhead the dialogue process, the UPND, that is the United Party for National Development in Zambia, are ready to take part in the dialogue process.
What is the expectation of the UPND as this dialogue is being organized and mediated by the three church mother bodies, as you rightly put it?
Well, basically, what we want is to have the burning issues in Zambia resolved through this dialogue process. And the burning issues relate to the electoral process and the management of elections in Zambia is highly flawed. We have evidence from the 2016 presidential and the general elections where things really went wrong. So we want a reform of the Electoral Commission of Zambia to make it independent and to have officials at the Electoral Commission of Zambia, especially the commissioners, to be appointed and represent various stakeholders in the country rather than just being appointees of the Republican president and representing only the ruling party.
Some Zambians are saying that the Electoral Commission has always been independent, so why insist on independence? And the fact that the electoral processes have been, as you described, a problem, some say that that argument is neither here nor there, since legally Zambians voted to elect Edgar Chagwa Lungu as the president of Zambia, although the UPND has refused to accept his electoral victory.
Well, the Electoral Commission of Zambia is not independent. All the officials there, including what we call the commissioners, who are also sit on the board of the Electoral Commission, are all appointees of Edgar Lungu. That cannot be called in the independence. We want those commissioners to represent various stakeholders, such as the political parties themselves, the media, the church, the non-government organizations, the lawyers, and all other stakeholders should be represented on that electoral commission.
But Charles, doesn't the constitution give the president the mandate to appoint members of the commission?
The constitution is flawed, and that constitution is a product of the one-party state, which was led by the former president, Kenneth Kaunda, when we had a one-party state, and that provision has not changed. And that's why we also want to reform the constitution to be relevant to the current scenario of a multi-party political system.
Charles Kakoma is the spokesman for Zambia's main opposition, UPND. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lusaka. The government of Rwanda says relations between Burundi and Uganda are at a low point, but Rwanda's new Foreign Affairs Minister, Richard Sisibera, says his country stands ready to help polish the strained relations between the two regional member countries. Sisibera, speaking Tuesday at his first news conference, said tensions tend to discourage regional development projects. Eugene Uwimana reports from Kigali.
Newly appointed Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation Minister Dr. Richard Sezibera confirmed that tensions between Rwanda, Burundi and Uganda have unfortunately soared. He said tensions rose in 2015 when hundreds of Burundian refugees fled to Kigali during the political crisis following the decision of President Pierre Nkurunziza to stand for a third term. Since 2015, the Nkurunziza administration has accused Rwanda of working with exiled Burundians to overthrow President Nkurunziza. Rwanda's government has repeatedly denied the allegations. Minister Sezibera says Rwanda is ready to ameliorate its relations with Burundi but he says Burundi has shown little interest. And despite the fact that Uganda played a role in making the new Rwanda's regime, the foreign minister says Rwanda has also accused Uganda of torturing some Rwandans who frequently travel to Kampala for personal business. The Rwandan government has also accused Uganda of hosting Rwandans who it said want to destabilize its system.
Those issues which need to be tackled so that the relationship between Rwanda and Uganda can be better, those issues are still not resolved, and we have to find a way of resolving them.
Another thorn in Rwanda's international relations that Minister says we are talking about are the tensions between Rwanda and South Africa. But he confirmed that the two countries are on their way to negotiating means to ease tensions. However, the government does not show any will to negotiate with the safe-called political players who sought refugee in Pretoria.
You do not play politics by committing crimes. Those who thrown grenades here in this country, killed our people, or intend to kill our people, that is not politics.
However, the Rwandan government says that there were many projects which were stunted due to these tensions. There are so many projects which were stunted, mainly in the Northern Corridor, especially the railway and electrical projects, as well as the ID used for free movement of people. Dr. Richard Sezibela replaced Louise Mushikiwabo in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Mushikiwabo was elected recently as the new secretary of the International Organization of La Francophonie. He also said that the recent African Union reforms included reducing the number of AU leadership members from 10 to 8, creating new departments and imposing a new sanctions regime, all of which he said will come into force in 2021. Dr. Richard Sezibela says that among the reforms, the AU Peace Fund was the milestone.
The fund currently has about $60.5 million contributions from member states. So this was historic.
Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali.
Environmental activists in Uganda are calling on the government to fund activities aimed at mitigating climate change and combating environmental changes. Activists warn a lack of government intervention in combating environmental changes will affect agriculture and development in the country. Mugumi Davis Rakarinj reports from Kampala.
While addressing members of civil society and government officials in Kampala this Wednesday, Professor David Mfitumuchiza, who teaches environment and natural resources at the Makerere University's Center for Climate Change, Research and Innovation, said climate changes may directly impact the availability of rainfall and water needed for plants and animals. Mfitumuchiza also said climate changes may result into floods that may wash away plants.
You are likely to have much more erosion and the sediment deposits in water bodies, including lakes and rivers, in a way that can affect its quality, affect the fish in those water bodies, but can also affect hydropower production. In terms of agriculture, you are talking about having problems to do with the scarcity of water when you need it, in a system of agriculture where people depend on rainfall.
Unfortunately, Mfitumuchiza says this mainly affects the very poor people who cannot use mechanized agriculture like irrigation. For example, Mfitumuchiza warns Uganda's temperatures might increase by 6 degrees Celsius, thus affect both plants and animal life. Uganda's average temperature is 26 degrees Celsius or 78 degrees Fahrenheit, and temperatures may range between 25 to 29 degrees Celsius or 77 to 84 degrees Fahrenheit. He says that is exactly why both African governments and the international community must invest in issues that affect climate.
The poor countries have been pushing for certain issues, and one of the issues that they have been pushing for is increasing financial commitments so that these poor countries can get the resources to implement their climate adaptation programs. What we want to do is to create a resilience of the economy, resilience of the communities. And to be able to do that, you need financial resources to design appropriate programs and implement these programs.
Onesimus Mujenyi, the Deputy Executive Director of Advocates Coalition for Development and Environment, or ACCORD, a regional public policy research and advocacy think tank based in Uganda, agrees.
Government should integrate issues of climate change
issues of adaptation, issues of climate resilience, one in the development plans, but also in policies, both at the national and local level.
Mujinyi also says the government must involve people from all walks of life, mainly youth and women, in protecting the environment. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinjini, Kampala, Uganda.
Two black rhinos died recently in Charles Zakuma National Park, bringing the total dead to four of the six rhinos that were transferred to Chad early this year. South Africa and Chad have an agreement to reintroduce rhinos to Chad after the last black rhino was recorded there in 1972. Orbi Modise, a spokesperson for South Africa's Department of Environmental Affairs, tells Ricky Shryak that the recent deaths were due to a parasite.
Well, South Africa and Chad signed a memorandum of understanding in areas of biodiversity conservation and cooperation in those particular areas. The translocation of the rhino came about as a result of that particular MOU signed by South Africa and Chad last year, where our late minister, Edna Molewa, joined by her counterpart in Chad, agreed on replenishing the depleted stock of rhino in Chad. And as part of the implementation of that particular memorandum of understanding, we translocated just about six rhino earlier this year to Chad.
And of those six rhino, how many are still alive?
Well, the report we got was that four out of the six have since died. The two are still alive and they are being monitored.
Is this a concerning number of deaths among the six black rhinos you transferred, or was this kind of expected because of transfer issues?
Well, we did not necessarily anticipate that we will get to where we are right now. We're extremely worried, which is why we have since dispatched our team of experts on the ground to come back with an indication of what could have led to the death.
So is there a hope that Zakuma National Park can still be a place where rhinos can be reintroduced to Chad?
We cannot at this point say anything about that. We will for now put on hold all plans to translocate further rhino to Chad until we are certain that the next batch translocation will not necessarily be facing the same challenge the first batch faced. So for us, it's the first batch where with the death of the four rhino, we are extremely concerned about the what could have led to their death, which indications are that it could have been they couldn't easily acclimatize to the environment there. But we'll know for sure once we get the full results, once our experts are back from Zakuma.
Why is it important to reintroduce rhinos into this part of the world, into Chad?
South Africa is the home of the biggest rhino population in the world. Part of our strategy is to ensure that we assist countries that would like to replenish their rhino stock. And part of the agreement with Chad, as we did with Tanzania before, as we did in Botswana, and as we did with other countries, we've been doing that, sharing with them our experiences, and in some instances, loaning some of our rhino to those countries to help them reintroduce their stock, but also in the main to ensure that the rhino continue to survive on the African continent.
Orbi Modise is the spokesman for South Africa's Department of Environmental Affairs. We're speaking to Ricky Stryak from Pretoria. And that is it for this Wednesday, November 21st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.